Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, election deniers are sounding the alarm about how long it will take to count all of the ballots in Maricopa County.
And what the emerging field of neuroaesthetics says about how our brains respond to what we see.
But first this morning, let's turn to Tucson and take a closer look at what's quickly become the most contentious local race in the region. Democratic Pima County Sheriff Chris Nanos is under fire this week for placing his Republican opponent and employee, Heather Lappin, on administrative leave just weeks before Election Day. Nanos says she violated internal policies, but his opponents accuse him of corruption and favoritism and are warning that if he is reelected, there will be a mass exodus of deputies from the department. Now, one Pima County supervisor is calling on Nanos to drop out of the race and receive a censure for his actions. Caitlin Schmidt is the publisher and editor of the nonprofit newsroom Tucson Spotlight, and she's on the line now to tell us more about it all. Thanks for coming on the show, Caitlin.
Thanks, Lauren.
Okay, so this race has gotten so contentious. There were deputies out protesting. Your outlet covered. They were sort of in disguise. They didn't want to reveal their identities. They had signs that said, you know, deputies don't want Nanos. What does the message look like from opponents like these?
Yeah, it seems like there's quite a bit of discord in the department. In addition to suspending Heather Lappin, Nanos also placed a sergeant on administrative leave a few weeks ago, one of the union leaders, and that was for allegedly campaigning in what appeared to be a uniform. So that was kind of the reason behind the costumes. But this sergeant told my reporter on Friday that he's spoken to at least 16 deputies who say that they will leave their jobs if Nanos is reelected, and they really are fearing that mass exodus that you mentioned. Yeah.
What do they say is behind that? Like, why are they so critical of him?
You know, they say that it's just been kind of some good old boy politics since he's taken office. And this has been dating back to 2015 when he was appointed by longtime sheriff, or when he replaced longtime sheriff Clarence Dupnik. He was appointed by Pima County supervisors at Dubnik's suggestion. And what we were told happened in the department was that, you know, Nanos has a quick temper. We've seen that. And he would promote people that were loyal to him and kind of retaliate against people that were not. And it's created a culture where people are afraid to speak up, to make suggestions about improvements. And there have been some actions that they're really unhappy with. There is a lawsuit involving a sergeant who is accused of sexually assaulting his deputy. That sergeant is still working at the department. There's been some controversies involving a corrections officer that was actually arrested for shoplifting and kept his job. So the cops out there that are just trying to keep their head down and do their job don't feel like they can under this culture.
Very interesting. Tell us more about why Heather Lappin was placed on administrative leave here. It has to do with the campaign, right?
Kind of. Yeah, it's always interesting when the news becomes the news.
Right.
So Nano said in his letter about her leave that she was suspended for allegedly colluding with a local reporter to facilitate payment to an inmate in the Pima County Jail. The outlet in question, the Arizona Luminaria, has since responded and said that what their reporter did was actually reimburse an inmate for a phone call in the jail. Mm-hmm. This was part of a years-long investigation. The Luminaria and other outlets have repeatedly reported on how hard it is to communicate with people in the jail, how expensive it is. So this was really just kind of a routine part of John Washington doing his job. Nanos told the Luminaria and some other outlets that the FBI and the State Attorney General's office had agreed to help in his investigation of Lappin in this situation, but the AG's office said last week that they had not agreed to this.
Has she responded to any of this, Heather Lappin?
Not so much. Both she and the other sergeants say that they've been placed on a gag order. She has not filed a lawsuit of her own, but the attorney representing Sergeant Cross had said that at this point, really nothing is out of the question.
What about Nanos? What's he saying about why he's doing this, the timing of it all, and the criticism he's receiving, especially from, as we mentioned, Pima County Supervisor Matt Hines, who's now calling for him to drop out of the election to be censured?
Yes. So Nanos is basically saying that other people are turning this into a political issue and that he's just trying to follow department guidelines and, you know, police his own police. He sent a 4-page letter to several outlets defending himself and really isn't touching on the timing. He's saying, you know, this just all came to his attention. But this is not the first time that he has suspended a political rival leading up to an election. He did this back in 2016. A sergeant then announced his candidacy and was promptly suspended, with Nano citing a county rule at the time that allowed for an employee to be suspended if campaigning interfered with their job performance. But that rule was changed last year.
Very interesting. Let me ask you lastly, in the last minute or so here, Caitlin, about the broader picture on this race. Where is the polling look? What does fundraising look like? Do we know who might win?
It's really tough to say. You know, unfortunately, a lot of people have turned in their ballots already and had before this news came out. Fundraising is really interesting. Heather Lappin has outraised Nanos 4 times in individual contributions. She's brought in a total of $113,000 this cycle to his about $30,000. And most of his came from personal loans, whereas hers were individual donations. This last cycle that just ended September 30th, he brought in $550 and she brought in almost $30,000. So if we're looking at where the money is, it seems like she has the support. But again, you know, Pima County is a largely Democratic voter base, and we saw Nanos win in 2020 because he replaced a Republican. So her party might be what's difficult for her.
Very interesting. All right. Lots to watch for as we get very close to Election Day here. Caitlin Schmidt, publisher and editor of the nonprofit newsroom, the Tucson Spotlight, joining us. Caitlin, thanks so much for coming on. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Lauren.
Election Day is drawing nearer. It's 1 week from tomorrow, in fact, so very near. More than 1 million Arizonans have already voted, and Maricopa County officials are trying to ward off panic by announcing early that it will take 10 to 13 days to count every ballot here. That has election deniers sounding the alarm, but our next guest this morning is here to point out it always takes time to count ballots. Elvia Diaz is the editorial page editor of the Arizona Republic, and she joins me now to talk more about it all. Good morning, Elvia.
Good morning.
Okay, so the county was really kind of trying to stave off concern with this announcement last week that it'll take 10 to 13 days to get every ballot through the process. But this seems to have set off even more concern.
Yeah, can you believe that? And actually, I do, because that's exactly what happened, you know, 2 years ago and 4 years ago. But essentially, nothing has happened in Maricopa County and in Arizona, because it is by state law that it takes time to count the ballots. You know, people are voting early, people are voting in person. But we know that there are some really bad actors already fueling into that conspiracy that the election system is broken, that county election workers are going to be cheating on Election Day, which is absolutely not true. But that feeds into the panic, right? And so we're already hearing from people, you know, thinking that any delay in knowing the election results on election night is going to be conspiracy, is going to be because someone is cheating, and that is just not the case.
And we pretty much know at this point, if we know anything about what's going to happen post-election day, that we will probably not have results right away, as the county is pointing out here. Columnist Lori Roberts pointed out in a column that this is how it's always been, like you say. She says it's taken on average 13 days to count ballots in Maricopa County in recent elections, in fact. And she talks about the reason why. You mentioned the state law. This is because of how county officials are required to count ballots, right?
Yes, exactly. So in Arizona, you are able to vote early. And I'm pretty sure a lot of you listening right now still have your early ballots. I still have to fill it out. I know I'm one of those. And so I count myself among those early voters, right? So there are tons of them. So if you mail your ballot and then it gets to the county, those votes are the ones that are results that we know exactly at 8 o'clock. So every election, they're usually early results that we call at 8 o'clock, and those are the early ballots. And then you have the people that are voting in person, right? So those are the ones that are going to be counting later. But so then there's the third action that happens, the early ballots that are turned in on election day. And those are the ones that takes the longest to count, because by law, they're not allowed to count them on election day. Mm-hmm. And it gets confusing. I mean, people forget, right? I mean, who's thinking about how ballots are counting, right, until it's actually time to vote? So yes, it is a process. It is the law. They can't do it. And there is a whole process that takes place with early balloting, right? So if you have your ballot, you don't mail it, you return it on election day, that ballot is going to take quite a few days to be counted because he has to go through a whole series of steps before he does. And that's why it takes longer.
Yes. And I've definitely been one of those people in the past as well. It does take longer. So I want to talk more broadly about this kind of underlying message, because it's a little convoluted. You've got election deniers saying this is an election emergency. People like Alex Jones, you've got Elon Musk kind of griping about it. You've got lots of folks kind of giving you this idea that this isn't like it used to be in the old days where we could count everything in a day. But at the same time, you've got lots of folks on both sides, including, you know, Donald Trump saying, please return your ballots early, vote early, vote early, vote early, as county officials are saying, right?
That's what is confusing. And it's most unfortunate that those people that you were mentioning, I mean, they're smart people. And I believe they're doing that on purpose to confuse voters. And that's my biggest worry, that they're doing it in anticipation of losing or blaming, you know, the election system for not liking the results at the end. And that's just horrific. That's just not good for democracy, not good for transparency. And if you remember the last election, Republican candidates and Donald Trump and everyone else were urging their voters not to vote early, just to go in person, not to trust the system. And now it's the opposite. Now they are telling them, vote early, vote early, vote early. And then at the same time, you have all these bad actors that you were mentioning, you know, saying that they're going to cheat, they're going to cheat. And so it's just a bad situation. And they do it in bad faith from my point of view. Anyone who wants to learn about how ballots are counted are free to do so. I mean, Maricopa County, for instance, which is run by Republicans, you know, elections are run by Republicans at the County Board of Supervisors and also at the Recorder's Office. They had been incredibly transparent and they had been open to whomever wants to learn about how ballots are counted. I mean, they give tours, they give all the information available. They have cameras everywhere. But again, I mean, people are not taking the time to actually learn all those steps, to actually see how it is done. And they just listen to this cacophony of voices that are telling you that the elections are rigged. And again, to me, it's an anticipation of not liking the results.
Interesting. Okay, so I want to ask you lastly about another story that's arisen as early voting numbers have rolled in. And that's been pointed out in columns on your pages, and you've mentioned here, Democrats are not voting early in the kinds of numbers they might have back in 2020, say. Republicans, though, seem to be doing it differently than they did in the last few elections. Cycles and voting early as they used to.
You know what? That's very interesting. I was looking at the numbers, and yes, it appears that more Republicans are returning their ballots compared to independents like you and I and Democrats. But, you know, I would like to think that it's probably because Arizona has a very long ballot and people are taking the time to actually fill out the entire ballot. I mean, I know I count myself as one of those people. I mean, I vote in every single line and I have like one or two really local races, like a school boards, for instance, that I want to do a little bit more research on before returning my ballot. So I would like to think that those people are, you know, just doing that. But it's also, you know, clearly there are others that are just forgetting about it and they're going to do it at the last minute. You know, it is important to mention that Republicans have a voter registration advantage statewide and also in Maricopa County. So that might be the reason why too. So again, maybe it is because there's a lot to learn about before filling out the ballot. I hope it's that.
All right. Elvia Diaz, editorial page editor of the Arizona Republic, joining us to talk more about all of this as we get ever closer to Election Day. Elvia, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
No, thank you. Reminding everyone to please vote, vote, and vote.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, the real-world consequences of portraying Latinos as drug dealers in pop culture.
An exhibit at the Scottsdale Museum of Contemporary Art challenges viewers to look at and think about art differently. But it's not an empty challenge. The show aims to give people some of the tools to start doing that. Brains and Beauty at the Intersection of Art and Neuroscience explores the emerging field of neuroaesthetics, which aims to find a biological basis for aesthetic experiences.
This is what I would identify as an educational exhibition, the way I describe that is that it's not as much about the artwork as it is about the idea that I'm trying to talk about.
That's Laura Hales, curator of learning and innovation at Scottsdale Arts. She collaborated with the director of neuroaesthetics at Penn to design the exhibit, which is centered around three large neural systems that activate during an aesthetic experience, like being in an art museum. Neuroaesthetics incorporates psychology and neurology to try to find out what's happening in our brains during an aesthetic experience and why people react the way they do.
As a museum educator, I'm fascinated by what people are thinking when they come into a museum. And I did not even realize there was a scientific discipline about this. But it's, you know, when people look at artwork, you know, sometimes they look at it for just a few seconds and walk away. Other times, you know, they'll stand in front of it for a very long time. And to me, it's interesting to find out what neurology is interested in about art and aesthetic experiences, because it helps me to be a museum educator, actually.
The galleries are organized into three sections representing something called the aesthetic triad. It describes three large brain systems. When I met Hales at SMOCO, we started in the emotion valuation system section, and I asked her to explain what that is and how the art in that area related to it.
The emotion valuation system is your emotional response, obviously, to artwork. And it's very subjective, although some artworks can elicit a more universal reaction. So, for example, I have this Rufino Tamayo here. And it is a person who is holding his or her ears, and I would say her ears, and she's got a red mask on. Well, red has been found to actually make you sweat more when you look at red. The same thing happens when you're anxious or when you're angry. So although the artist, I'm sure, didn't realize that at the time that he created this painting, intuitively, he knew that red is a color that can evoke that kind of response in somebody.
Well, and over this way, there are a couple paintings of people by Chris Rush.
Right.
And these are people who, I guess I could say, don't look like the types of people you would typically see in a painting.
Yeah, Chris Rush painted people with facial anomalies and in a very dignified way. And I like this work because it brings up an issue with human behavior. When we look at somebody who is not part of what we consider to be our ideal beautiful person, it creates a reaction in our brains that is actually kind of troubling, but with education, you can get over it, and most people do, I hope. And that is that the area in the brain that's responsible for high attention increases. So you're paying a lot of attention to somebody who might be different than you, but then the empathetic response, your feeling of warmth and kindness towards that person is decreased. Now, this has to do with everybody's own idea of what beauty is, and that is subjective to a point, although we are kind of hardwired to look at symmetry as something that's beautiful.
Throughout the galleries, there are monitors set up for each part of the triad with animations of the brain. Hale says that's so viewers can see which parts of the brain light up during aesthetic experiences that involve specific systems. Just behind the emotion valuation system, we find the knowledge meaning system. Again, Hales explains.
The knowledge meaning system is, you'd consider that a top-down cognition, whereas the other two are sort of bottom-up cognition, because in the top-down, you need to know about context, and you have to have a little bit of background information, or at least read the label and then reconsider the artwork through what you know. Whereas, say, the emotion valuation system, you can just feel an artwork without having that information. Although most aesthetic experiences, I'd say all aesthetic experiences actually, involve all three of these systems, some combination of the three.
Whether or not we know it at the time or not,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly, yeah.
So are these pieces, and is maybe this section, less maybe a visceral reaction and more of a, okay, let me look at it, then let me learn a little more about it, then let me figure out how I feel about it?
I think these are examples of artwork that when you know the context, it makes you think of it a lot differently.
The third aspect of the triad is the sensory motor system. Hale says this refers to what you perceive when you look at a piece of art, like an initial gut reaction, what color it is, what is the piece depicting, that kind of thing. She says it also refers to the brain areas that automatically recognize things like landscapes and faces and includes motion, both real and implied. And as Hales and I are standing in the galleries looking at art and talking about how the brain reacts to it, it occurs to me that this is a pretty good deal for a museum, having an exhibit that tries to figure out how people respond to art, which is a reason people would come to a museum in the first place.
Yeah, exactly. It is in a sense, this exhibition is more so people, I want people to learn about neuroaesthetics, because it's a growing field. It's only been around about 20 years and it's kind of exploding all over the place. There's lots of implications for neuroaesthetics in architecture, in medicine, in education, and all of that. So I want people to start thinking about it because it's going to be, you know, more and more known in the future, but also because to me, it's fascinating that art is a major part of this research, and that I think that this was a really fun way to show that and to explain the research through the artworks.
Have you found that you are looking at pieces of art differently, knowing what you know about neuroaesthetics?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And that is interesting. These galleries are set up to sort of strongly suggest one of the three parts of the triad, but all aesthetic experiences incorporate all three. So when I look at art now, I try to analyze, okay, now what's the knowledge meaning and what's the sensory emotion? And yeah, so that's, of course, this exhibition is, I don't know if that's gonna last for the rest of my life, but for right now, yeah, absolutely, I'm looking at art differently.
Well, it's very meta, right? You're thinking about, in an art gallery, thinking about how you, an art educator, are thinking about art.
Yeah, exactly, it's metacognitive for sure, yeah.
Laura Hales is curator of learning and innovation at Scottsdale Arts. The exhibit, Brains and Beauty, at the intersection of art and neuroscience, will be on display at the Scottsdale Museum of Contemporary Art through mid-January.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Israeli strikes on Iran over the weekend have observers talking about an increase in tension in the Middle East. The strikes were in response to an Iranian attack on Israel earlier this month. With me via Skype for our weekly look at some of the key global stories in the coming days is the BBC's Pete Ross in London. And Pete, how do you see things in the Middle East unfolding this week?
I think the first thing to say, Mark, is the world is waiting once again to see if Iran will retaliate after these Israeli airstrikes on Saturday. Israel said it targeted military sites in the strikes in various regions of Iran, and it says that the strikes were in retaliation for Iranian attacks, including a barrage of almost 200 ballistic missiles fired towards Israel at the beginning of the month. That was on October 1st. So we've been waiting for an Israeli response. That came this weekend. And now we're once again waiting to see if Iran will respond. Now, official Iranian sources have publicly played down the impact of the attack over the weekend. Also, Iran's Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei has so far given a pretty measured response to Israeli strikes on the country, saying the attack should not be, quote, exaggerated or downplayed. He's also refrained from pledging immediate retaliation. Now, I'd say this is a much more measured tone from Iran's Supreme Leader compared to some of the fiery and menacing language he's used in the past. Now, some analysts say this could be an attempt to avoid appearing weak for not responding decisively, because what he's done is he's also said that he wants to pass the responsibility on to the authorities about the next step. So he says it's not up to him. And some analysts suggest that this could be an attempt to avoid appearing weak and putting the decision onto someone else, or to deflect blame, basically, if a retaliation were to backfire and prompt an even bigger devastating response from Israel. On the Israeli side, the strikes were more limited than some observers had been expecting. The US had publicly pressured Benjamin Netanyahu's government not to hit oil and nuclear facilities, which it had at one point perhaps threatened to do. And this advice seems to have been taken on board by Israel. That could be why we're now getting a pretty measured response from Iran. So at this point, I reckon it's fair to say there's been a slight change in temperature. You know, hostilities are perhaps dialed down slightly, but of course the situation is still very volatile and Iran could still retaliate at any moment, of course, further increasing the chance of a wider conflict in the Middle East.
Sure. All right, Pete, let's go now to the EU, where big tariffs on Chinese-made electric vehicles are due to come into effect on Thursday. This follows an anti-subsidy investigation by the bloc, which is worried about cheap electric vehicles from China flooding the market. What can you tell us about this one?
The European Union has expressed concern over increasing numbers of Chinese or electric vehicles made in China entering the European market for quite some time now. The bloc's worried that these vehicles, which are often subsidised by the Chinese government, could undermine European manufacturers. And in fact, it launched an investigation which concluded last year to say that it does think that subsidies from the Chinese government give manufacturers of electric vehicles in China an unfair advantage, and that it's distorting the market in the European Union. So, at the beginning of this month, the EU voted to substantially increase tariffs. Just to say at this point, any vehicle, any motor vehicle made outside the EU are already subject to a 10% sales tariff. That's fairly standard. But in October, the bloc voted to increase those tariffs on some Chinese-made EVs to as much as 45%. However, this decision has not been without controversy. Germany and some other EU members have voiced concerns. They fear economic retaliation from China, which has hinted at possible countermeasures, including restrictions on other European goods. However, over the weekend, the EU has announced that it is open and is happy or is willing to have further negotiations with China. So these tariffs are due to come into effect on Thursday. That is still at this point, it seems likely that that's going to happen, but perhaps last minute negotiations between Beijing and the bloc could see those tariffs reduced or some other measures put in place. And of course, the rest of the electronic vehicle manufacturing world will certainly be watching this kind of to and fro, this arm wrestle, very closely indeed.
Sure. All right, Pete, finally, let's go to Moldova. The Eastern European nation is voting again this week in a presidential election runoff. This is coming amid accusations of interference from Russia. So why is this vote significant?
Yeah, consequential presidential elections amid Russian interference. This is not something that we are that is new to our ears, we could say. For Moldovans, it's actually going to be the third significant vote they're going to be asked to make in the space of a couple of weeks. Last Sunday, Moldovans went to the poll to vote in a presidential election and a referendum on the country's pursuit of EU membership. Both votes were far closer than expected. The final referendum result was 50.38% for yes, 49.62% for no. The president of the country, Maia Sandu, slammed the result at the time, saying it was a product of foreign interference. And she points the finger firmly to blame at Russia. Now, Kremlin has denied meddling in Moldova. But if we look at what's going on in the region today, for example, you had Georgian elections, which have also been disputed, both internationally and within the country, again suggesting that Moscow has had some political interference there as well. So this coming Sunday, what we have going on in Moldova is a runoff in the presidential election. I mentioned the president, Maia Sandu, earlier there. She did win the initial vote, but only with 42% of the vote. And in Moldova, you need to win by 50% or more to prevent a runoff. So that's going to happen this Sunday. And again, this is far closer than expected. The president will now face a runoff against Alexander Stoyanoglo. He's a former prosecutor general, and he's supported by pro-Russian party socialists. Again, Moscow says it has had nothing to do with the closeness of these votes. But look to this Sunday, because it's, you know, again, it's in this region, in this part of the world, we're getting a push and pull between the influences of Europe and the influences of Russia. And this is just another example of that push and pull. So it would be very significant if, I would suggest it would be very significant if Maya Sandu does not win, as many expect her to win this runoff coming on Sunday.
Interesting. All right. That is the BBC's Pete Ross in London. Pete, good as always to talk to you. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. So much of the rhetoric around immigration leading up to Election Day has been about drugs. Former President Donald Trump and his running mate have made the narrative that immigrants are bringing drugs to America central to their immigration message. The reality is most drugs smuggled across the border are smuggled through U.S. ports of entry by U.S. citizens. But our next guest says the story connecting immigrants to drugs is an old one, and it has to do with how Latinos are portrayed in pop culture. In fact, Jason Rees wrote a book about it. It's called Narco Media, and I spoke with him more about it.
I think Latinos have been at the center of war on drugs narrative since the 70s and 80s, when Nixon and then the Reagan administration really declare drugs as public enemy number one. But the history is a lot deeper than that. Mm. If we go back 100 years or longer, you see that pop culture was presenting drug problems as part of race problems. African-American cocaine users in the early 20th century as particularly threatening to the U.S. body politic, or Chinese immigrants and the opium den as a site of danger and despair in pop culture. So I think the bigger argument is that drugs have always been racialized in U.S. pop culture and political culture. The enemies change over the decades and over the years, though. So what I started noticing is that in the 80s, Latinos really become a focal point, a source of anxiety in American pop culture and political culture, based on a variety of factors, including immigration and the so-called cocaine crisis of the 80s and 90s.
Yeah. Why do you think we are so obsessed with these kinds of stories in America in particular and in pop culture? Like, they seem to repeat, and still today to repeat.
This is a question that really haunts me, because we do keep telling the same story over and over again. If you look at some of the narratives of the early 80s that were really anxious about Latino immigration, Scarface, a famous example.
You want to play a game? Okay. Have a night with you. Come on. Okay. Do you want to play rough? Okay. No. Say hello to my little friend.
Lots of episodes of Miami Vice and other TV crime shows in the 80s. Those stories are very similar to some of the stories that you see in more recent texts like Sons of Anarchy or Narcos and that whole Narcos universe that's been created on Netflix. I'm not exactly sure why we tell the same stories over and over again, but I'm pretty sure that we do keep consuming them.
Yeah. I want to ask a question about how these kinds of stories play in other parts of the world, like in other countries. I wonder, like in Mexico or in broader Latin America, do you see a lot of the same kinds of, you know, narco media stories?
I do. Mexican pop culture is full of narco stories. Huh. You could go back to narco corridos from decades ago that often celebrate drug kingpins, drug lords, but also reflect the anxieties in Mexican society about what does it mean that we're a drug producing country. But I think an even better example than Mexico is Colombia, because as you know, you can imagine, Colombian history is really marred by the cartel era in the 80s and 90s. And mainstream Colombian popular culture has been much more anxious about representing that era. A good example of that is Pablo Escobar. If you look at a famous Colombian telenovela that your listeners could watch on Netflix, it's called El Patrón del Mal, which it kind of translates to the Lord of Evil.
Todos sabemos lo que hizo, pero muy pocos han visto cómo lo hizo. hasta ahora. Pablo Escobar, el patrón del mal.
In Colombian popular culture, Pablo Escobar is considered like public enemy number one, the worst guy that ever lived, the worst thing that ever happened to Colombia. That's how Colombians have narrated the Pablo Escobar story. In Narcos, a show that, you know, look, I'm a fan of, but in Narcos, Pablo Escobar is a much more complicated figure.
Imagine you were born in a poor family, in a poor country. And by the time you were 28 years old, you have so much money you can't even count it.
Señores, yo soy Pablo Emilio Escobar Gaviria.
He's not just intrinsically evil. He is kind of an anti-hero like you'd see in Breaking Bad or The Sopranos. So what I argue in the book is that in Colombia, the stakes are a lot higher for how you would represent Pablo Escobar.
That's fascinating, yeah.
He did wreak so much havoc in the country.
Huh. So I want to ask about that, right? Because I think the depth, the nuance, the kind of character building, that anti-hero story that we see so often in U.S. pop culture today, whether it's Walter White or Tony Soprano, is often not the Latino character, but it is when it comes to Pablo Escobar in Narcos. Are there a lot of examples of that?
Short answer, no.
Yeah.
But I've got to tell you, this is so complicated for me because on the one hand, Wagner Moura's characterization of Pablo Escobar in Narcos is a masterpiece. He gives depth and nuance to a character that is so often just a bad guy. The Latino bad guy is something we've all seen in pop culture for our whole lives. Mm-hmm. It's very rare that you get a Latino character that has so much nuance and depth. But I can't help but also notice that one of the most delicately and deeply painted portraits of a Latino character, a Latin American character, is a bad guy, is one of the drug dealers that have done the most harm to Colombians, to Americans, to the world. One of the most successful criminal enterprises in world history was led by Pablo Escobar. Mm-hmm. And we don't see a lot of U.S. pop culture that gives everyday Latinos that much depth or humanity, really.
Yeah. So I want to talk about the harm that that does, right? Like the pervasiveness of these kinds of narratives in American media. What does that do to the broader Latino community or psyche?
It's such a good question. And I think with my students, I'm always trying to get them to go beyond just, I need to see people who look like me on screen.
Right.
I need to see people, you know, who have my shared experience on TV or in movies. That's true and that's important, and role modeling is good. But I think there's something so much deeper going on. As I got more deeply into the research for the book, I started feeling very frustrated that for Latino viewers, it's not just about seeing yourself represented on screen, but it's also about who is really portrayed as a fully fledged human being on screen. Mm. And Latinos have been excluded from that for so long. For most of media history, and if we're talking about film and TV, Latinos have been bad guys. They've been background actors. They've been maids or busboys. They haven't been granted this full humanity that media gives to other groups.
Right. So it's not just representation, it's what kind, right?
Exactly.
So I want to ask you before I let you go, Jason, about some of the rhetoric today that we're hearing around Latinos in general. I mean, we're just weeks away from a very consequential election. We've got so much immigration rhetoric in the kind of pop culture psyche right now and in the political sphere about immigration, about immigrants bringing drugs, about the sort of connection between, you know, certain people from certain parts of the world and drugs and problems in this country. Do you think there's a connection there between this kind of narco media and what we're hearing today?
Of course I do. There's a very observable connection. If you go back to Trump's original comments about the bad hombres that caused sort of a media moment, if you look at the full transcript, it's about drugs, actually. He's saying these are bad guys bringing drugs into the United States. And he repeated this narrative that connects drugs and Latino immigrants again in the one debate with Vice President Harris. Of course, a tiny percentage of immigrants from any country are connected to the drug trade or the drug economy. But this type of generalization is an old trick as we can observe from 50 years of what I call narco media, but it's effective and it's been working for him.
Yeah. All right. We'll leave it there for now. Jason Ruiz, professor and chair of American Studies at the University of Notre Dame, author of the 2023 book Narco Media, joining us to talk more about this. Jason, thank you for coming on. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Long before Nina Newell was a pediatrician and writer here in Arizona, she and her family were refugees from Vietnam. They made a narrow escape from Saigon on a boat in 1975, and the trouble didn't end there. After the family made it to the U.S., Nina endured a period of homelessness before ultimately earning her medical degree. When she met filmmaker Cindy Lee in a writing class, Lee was bowled over by Newell's story and asked if she could turn it into a documentary film. The Stories They Didn't Tell Us, Nina's Story, premiered at the Phoenix Film Festival earlier this year, and Lee was named Filmmaker of the Year. The film was named Best Documentary Short by the Chicago Indie Film Awards and Audience Choice at the Lowell Asian American Film Festival. This is the first time Newell has really opened up to anyone, including her own family, about the details of her harrowing escape. Newell and Lee spoke with the show's Sam Dingman this spring about the delicate art of real-life family drama.
You know, I have certain memory and flashes in my head, but at one point when Cindy interviewed me, I was like, that did happen. It wasn't a movie I saw.
Huh.
Oh, it wasn't, my imagination. So, I had that.
Was that something you'd been concerned about, that there were memories you had that you weren't sure if you could trust?
Oh, totally, completely. Because people ask, how did you survive that, you know, like when you're a kid? And I think, actually, I kind of dissociate a lot as a child. I remember being on the boat and thousands of people, and we had like a corner of a blanket that was our family space. And just sitting there and just seeing a lot of people crying, sad-knit kids, and a lot of things. And I remember going, okay, I'm not here. I'm somewhere else.
You remember consciously thinking,
I do remember.
I'm not here.
And that was my coping.
Wow.
I'm not here. I'm whatever it is. I wasn't really living in the present.
Yeah. You're making me think of one of the most harrowing moments in the film, which comes quite early when this is before the crossing on the boat, when you're still very young and you tell the story of being sent out to get groceries and having to step over the dead bodies and telling yourself, I need to make sure I get the right change. I thought that was such a powerful illustration of the kind of headspace you have to find as a young child when you're confronted with something overwhelming.
That's a good word, headspace. Yes. And I don't think as a kid, I thought that was a horrible, you know, thing, because it's kind of normal. And I remember feeling I was kind of proud that I got the change and money and I was interested. I think it's like everything until I was like a lot older. And maybe when I was a parent, I was like, and my kids were six. And I'm like, wow.
Cindy, if I could bring you into the conversation, how did you encounter Nina's story?
The first time I got any piece of it was when we shared the introduction to creative nonfiction writing class. Mm-hmm. There was some story that she had written, and it was really, it's one of those wow stories.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And so that was the first time.
And what made you decide that you wanted to turn it into a film?
Well, first of all, the title of the film is The Stories They Didn't Tell Us, and this is Nina's story. But that's actually my lived experience also. So my father came in 1948, just after World War II. He came from Korea. And there were losses. He had lost his family to bombing during the Korean War when he was here. So there were stories that we never heard as kids growing up as American kids. My father just didn't tell us those stories. My father was 96 last year. My dad had some weird lung thing that showed up, so they wanted to do an MRI. I took him to the place where the MRI, and he's getting in, and, you know, it's this long tube thing. And he said, you know, I have claustrophobia. And I said, really, Dad? And he said, yeah, because when I was young, I was put into, his family was involved in sort of an underground freedom movement. And so he was actually, as a I guess, late teenager, put into prison or jail. So he was in a room full of men, and sleeping quarters was shoulder to shoulder.
My God.
With people. And he said you could feel bugs running across you and so on. So in a normal household situation, going to work, in the car and whatever, you don't encounter this sort of, but suddenly the idea of an MRI, and it conjured up in his mind, so it kind of made the correlation. That was the first time I'd heard about that. So
at 96?
At 96.
For both of you, with your own parents, did you feel any sense of the lack of being told certain details outside of what you remembered from your own lived experience or stories that you didn't even know had happened? Did you experience that as a lack? Did you wish that you had been told those stories sooner?
Actually, I remember being a young child and feeling very responsible for my parents' pain, or whatever it was, the trauma, or just hard life. And
can I ask you quickly about that? You felt responsible in the sense that you felt like they had endured what they had endured on your behalf? What was that responsibility?
To do better. So that's why when I had my children, it was intentional. You know, I didn't want them to feel responsible.
Cindy, what about you? Did you experience the lack of those stories as a lack?
When my father came, it was 1948, there weren't many Korean people, so there was no community. So we're in a suburban community and just want to fit in. So you're just interested in being like everybody else, and you're a kid. So you're focusing on you and not about, gee, I wonder if my parents had some sort of history that's interesting for me to know, because your focus is around yourself, right?
Sure.
So really, a lot of it is we didn't ask. But as we got older, and my parents actually moved when he was 65, they moved back to Korea. We went to visit in Korea, and some of the stories started coming out. And I said, Dad, how come we didn't ever hear these stories before? He said, well, you were young, and until you came to Korea, I didn't think you would be able to understand.
I think this is something that doesn't get talked about enough, which is that, like wine, stories have terroir. You know, they don't really make sense unless they're told in a certain environment and maybe at a certain point in chronological history. And with that in mind, I'm curious, you know, you already described feeling sort of dragged back into history. And I'm wondering, after you ended up in the context of this interview, telling these stories, talking about these things that you hadn't spoken about previously, did you then go to your kids and go to your husband and say, you're about to find out some things about my life? Or were you content to let them find them out from the film?
I was content to let them find out from the film. So even now, it actually, to be honest, even after the film, we still don't sit and talk about it. I didn't realize that the wall that I had put up inadvertently, and unfortunately, I think that wall doesn't come down as easy as I would like.
Cindy, I wonder if I could ask you, there's this tension when you're making documentaries in general about the nature of authorship, because you're ostensibly just telling somebody else's story. But of course, your own artistic taste, your own interest in what happens in the story is going to inform that telling. And that's particularly true when you have a family history that is closely related to the story that you're telling. So how do you think about that challenge, or how did you think about that on this film?
In January of last year, I lost my husband. And I was in a podcast class, and I thought I would just drop it. And then I decided, no, I want to keep doing what I'm doing. And we had an interview assignment. So I asked my father, would you be willing to let me interview you? And he knew that I'd lost my husband. He wanted to make me happy. He goes, I will do anything. So I was planning to interview him in June. And in mid-May, my dad fell, hit his head, and died.
Oh, my God.
So I had lost the opportunity to capture his stories. So Nina, who knew that I'd lost my husband, and I told her about my dad, and she said, I'm here for you. And so I came back to her and I said, would you be willing to let me interview you about your story? And her reaction was, oh, gosh.
Casserole.
She meant comfort and casseroles, but not necessarily that. So
you got more than you bargained for.
So anyway, she thought about it and she said, yes, I will do that for you. And that's how this came about.
Wow.
So this film for me is more than just a film. It's about the amazing things that can come out of profound loss, perseverance, overcoming, and becoming.
That'll do it for this Monday edition of the show. Be sure to join us tomorrow with much more. And don't forget, we are on Instagram with all the cool kids, right? We are at KJZZ, the show right there. You can find us if you search. For Mark Brody, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us today.
That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.